What I'm going to try to do is give you a way to take this unruly and remarkable work, the Mahabharata, and give it some kind of frame of reference so that you can interpret it, so that while you're trying just to learn the plot and try to understand how the story goes, with all of its peculiar twists and turns, we also have an interpretive model that helps us sort of understand what we might make of it. Now, a few historical footnotes. Mahabharata is almost 99,000 lines of poetry, okay? If you think about that, that's an astonishing achievement. And one of the first things to notice, and we won't go on very much about this because we could talk about its composition and compilation and how the stories have been aggregated and how it turned out to be this sort of behemoth that takes up, you know, a shelf in the library. It's composed and collected over about an 800-year period. In the case of Indian texts, it's almost always impossible to pin dates on texts, except and particularly because of the peculiar ways in which the aggregate itself is created by the algorithm of Sanskrit. So the language itself comes a few centuries before the compilations of the Mahabharata begin. So we date Mahabharata about 400 before the Christian era to about 400 CE, so over about an 800-year period of composition. Now, what makes that astonishing is that languages naturally change over such an extended period of time. Within 500 years, a native language will seem estranged to you in almost every case. This is just ordinary in the history of language, in the history of linguistics and social organization. Languages evolve organically and naturally by usage. They develop dialect, they develop vernacular, colloquialisms are the peculiar kind of phrases that tag an age. There's all kinds of ways in which language itself does its business to sort of keep up and re-represent society's self-understanding to itself. The peculiarity here is again re-represented in the very strange way in which Sanskrit is not organic but artificial. And it's artificial because, again, right before the age of the Buddha, which is right before the beginnings of the compositional aggregation of the Mahabharata, Indian culture took its ancient repository, its ancient language, and it codified it. It wrote rules for it. That's why I keep calling it an algorithm. Sanskrit is a body of rules and then everything that follows that original ideology of the organization of the language, which happens between 600 and 500 before the Christian era, the grammarians come, kind of take hold of the old material. We've talked about this at some length. I won't go on too much about it, except to say that everything that follows in its wake follows from the rules. So the language that everyone begins speaking on the street does exactly what we would expect language to do. It organically evolves, it develops. And we see that now, of course, in North India, where every language of modern North India, with a handful of rare exceptions, are daughter languages of the Vedic and Sanskrit model. That's because they've continued to sort of just grow in history and work their way through the complexities of social historical usage. In Sanskrit, we have a peculiar usage here because the Sanskrit of the Mahabharata is literally what we call epic Sanskrit. We'll stop and talk about what epics are in a moment. So it's a kind of Sanskrit that was particularly used for oral presentation and for the peculiar ways in which those oral presentations could be reasonably followed by people who would not be technically familiar with the language. So, for example, if you are a modern-day Hindi speaker, you'll recognize some of the vocabulary of Sanskrit. But to think that your mother tongue is that language is a mistake. But epic Sanskrit is designed in a certain way to give enough cues and enough kind of entertainment inside its own organization. Because this is sort of one of the great sort of phenomena of history, when something so popular or so entertaining, something so central to culture, was also the great artistry of culture. And think about that. That's a rare occurrence. I mean, Shakespeare was both the popular theater of his age, and he was Shakespeare. I mean, are we kidding ourselves? Like that's art. That's probably only happened in America between 1957 and 1980, when the great art created out of America was rock and roll, and it was what made the radio vibrate. Like, everybody listened to it. So when does that, whether or not that's possible or not anymore in such a kind of diverse, globalized, fragmented cultural organization as our own societies now, is another issue. But Sanskrit is like that in the case of Mahabharata and its companion text, the epic that we're not reading in this class, and that would be the Ramayana. Ramayana is the companion to Mahabharata, and it is by far the much more popular, one might even argue more influential, of the two great Indian epics. Mahabharata is not as well understood or as well told or as theologically influential as Ramayana, but I submit to you, and I'll try to explain to you why, it's a million times better. It's incomparably better. And part of the reason it doesn't strike the same chord as Ramayana is because throughout it, you're going to find that the same sorts of issues you have in understanding the text would also be popular issues. Mahabharata is, I said, composed over 800 years. It's the continuity of that language happens, again, because of the peculiar way in which Sanskrit is composed, and then composed in this kind of epic song style that allows people to sort of follow some of it. But think about this, just pause here too, just to make one more linguistic remark. If you tracked back the English we are speaking 800 years from today, right? Say we're at the end of the Mahabharata era, right? And what do you think that English would sound like? Does anyone, let's stop and ask an easier question. What language is the closest relative to English? Does anyone know? It's a really peculiar one. You wouldn't know this. It's called Frisian. Frisian is the closest linguistic relative to English. Frisian is a kind of Dutch. And the line between what makes a language and not just a dialect is a heady question among linguists. Like, when do you finally draw that line? You know, why is Catalan not really Castilian Spanish? Is the same kind of question. Well, here. So Frisian is a kind of Dutch, and the reason for that, and if you heard Frisian today, it would sound, if you had an ear for it, it would sound like Dutch or German to you. And a Frisian speaker would find more affinity to Dutch or German than they would to English. But English also has a very peculiar history of how it grows and how it evolves and what happens at a certain point in its history and its origins as a Saxon language. But it basically does follow our template, and that is 500 years back. Think about it. We're in Shakespeare. I don't know how many of you have read much Shakespeare, but even the language is a little hard to follow. Go back 800 years, you're well past Chaucer, you're near Beowulf. That's a language that sounds like nothing to you, okay? So, and that's just the normal evolution of ordinary speech. So one of the things that makes this such a remarkable work is that the language itself, because it's built on this linguistic algorithm, doesn't effectively change over the 800-year compilation and aggregation of the story. There's no way when you read Mahabharata particularly to notice what's older or earlier just by the nature of the language. There's been some really interesting study about what was orally composed and what was composed in written forms because of the complexity or the peculiar usages, but the language itself didn't change very much. And that makes it something astonishing as a repository of memory. Think of that. That this, as a culture, has the capacity from and then think of life expectancies in the ancient world and things like that. Think that most folk have a productive life of about 20 years. Say between 20 and 40, right? And so, how many generations does it take to create an 800-year composition aggregate, right? In a way in which from beginning to end, Everyone is, in some sense, on exactly the same page. Now think of how much historical and cultural and intellectual memory and emotional memory can be contained in a work like that. Because literally, if a generation is 20 years, let's shorten it to 10, right? We're looking back 800 generations, right, of human beings who have, in some sense, a real and developed connection to each other because they're working, in some sense, in the same model, in the same world, using exactly the same methods of composition and aggregation. So this is an amazing work of the, and it may in fact be, as I'll try to show you today, probably the greatest living example of the Jungian theory of collective memory and the collective unconscious. If we were looking for, if we're looking for sort of the hard evidence of how memory does its business and how it, how culture soaks in its deepest and most sort of redolent sensibilities, here, Mahabharata is going to give us a real kind of astonishing example of how what collective memory can do is unlike what any individual could possibly have done. And that in that collection of ideation is not only kind of a historical fact, I want you in 1 second, not only a historical feature of its composition, it's also this remarkable way in which one might, we can see sort of the deep sensibilities, the structure of consciousness itself operating, and I'll try to show you that, you know, in 2 or 3 lectures. Spencer?
You might have already said it, but was there some system or guild or group of people that was responsible for writing this
work? Yeah. So, and we've already actually met one of them, and that would be Krishna of the Gita. So that the class of characters socially responsible for kind of aggregating and creating and sustaining the forensics of the text are called Sutta, S-U-T-A. The word means the bard, B-A-R-D, like the poet, the reciter. And Suttas are, by caste, also connected to warriors. The word also means charioteer. Now, that makes perfect sense in a warrior culture, that the one who lives to tell your story is the guy who drove the car, right? Like, That's by the rules of war, we've already mentioned this before in the study of the Gita, that the charioteers are supposed to survive the war because they're non-combatants. And as you watch the movie, you'll find out why Krishna is the non-combatant driving Arjuna's chariot and how sort of strange and mysteriously ironic all of that is. But we can still meet these bards who are capable of literally pulling themselves together to recite 100,000 lines. To this day, on the rarest of occasions, and it has to do partly with the nature of the text itself, not its length or its duration, but its subject matter is part of what makes it a less popular bardic story. Mahabharata traditionally is not told in households. It must be told in public. And that's because it's a story of strife, of war, of chaos, of legitimacy, of illegitimacies, of, it's filled with sort of the mystery of conflict. And because it's so fundamentally rooted in the idea that conflict, I'm going to let you in too, that conflict is innate, conflict is not something we resolve, it's something that we negotiate with, that it's inherent to the structures of reality itself, that the world is, crisis is Mahabharata's, one of Mahabharata's most important basic commitments, its thesis, and that crisis exacerbated leads to criticalities that then take us to challenges that are catastrophic and conflicted. And so how crisis becomes exacerbated into conflict and how conflict becomes catastrophic is a critical issue we study when we look at what the content of Mahabharata is doing. The reason the suttas are less, and that's the principal reason why the story is not told privately in homes. So if you meet Hindu families, almost all of them have some relationship to the Ramayana. Like, that's what you hear at home. That's the story grandma tells. But almost no one tells Mahabharata stories. And that's precisely because of this sort of organizational issue, that the structure of the world is built on a kind of deepening and embedded notion that every moment raises crisis because we live in we live through fundamental forms of irresolvable paradox, and we'll talk about that too as we go forward in the content of the story. The bards themselves are still alive and well, and what's most interesting about them is that they're almost all illiterate. That is to say, we have written forms of Mahabharata. Now we use the form that forms the basis for your 1,000 verse short rendition here is called the critical edition. We could talk about its organization and composition. It's a kind of the result of a group of Indian scholars from the 1950s who came out of a particular university in Western India. They were astonishing and amazing characters. And how they collected manuscripts from all the four corners of India and then just kind of decided on the text, attempting to try to settle the matter of what is the Mahabharata, if in fact, anthropologically speaking, historically speaking, it's whatever anyone was reciting. And yet there's this astonishing body of continuity from Kashmir in the north to Kanyakumari at the tip, you know, from the edge of Gujarat to Bengal, that both linguistically and in terms of content, the manuscripts show an amazing body of range and variation, but also an astonishing bit of continuity. The text itself represents kind of the problematic of being human. And that is, how do we hold things together when the world naturally falls apart? When change and mutation and strife are kind of fundamental to the organization of the world, and yet what we have to do to live in the world is try to maintain or observe and create and participate in some sensibility of order, of meaning, of holding it together. It's a fundamental and simple issue. You know, every single moment of your life is the crisis of trying to hold it together in a world built of entropy and time. Like, it's moving from order to disorder, and time is degradation by definition. Like, you're not quite feeling it yet because you're still on the other side of the slope. Wait. Like, sooner or later, it comes tumbling down. How the fuse is burning at three ends. So it's holding a whole sort of host of fundamental sort of problematics that tell us that kind of point in two directions. There are problems we can solve, and then there are situations or paradoxes that we have to learn in some sense to recognize, embrace, and then kind of deal with for their irresolvabilities, for their problematics. Like, it doesn't take long to notice that how messy your desk can get in an afternoon. And then the amount of effort it takes to put it back together. The crisis of information is a crisis of entropy. Things fall apart, right? And we see it in much more kind of sophisticated systems theories that we also study today that, again, turn back to the organization of this text in really interesting ways. Because there is a kind of, there's a sensibility of in Mahabharata that there is a storyline. There's a way to kind of dodge and weave and vector your way through through a story that's designed in its most coherent fashion to be like a maze. Like, you enter this thing and getting lost, like if you have started at all just to read the rendition I've given you, you're likely overwhelmed just by the names and who's on first and what's on second. You know, like, you're in an Abbott and Costello thing, like, by page 3. You're supposed to get lost. Life is filled with mazes and dead ends and broken lines of sight and unfinished stories. That's part of its thesis. And yet there is a way sort of into this maze and a way to find its end game. And then while you're in the maze, leaving aside the question of what is the principal narrative that drives the text, like, what's the storyline? Again, you're helped here a little bit both by the Peter Brook movie and by this Narasimhan translation, because both of them kind of concentrate on the principal narrative, or what they understand to be the principal narrative, which is itself kind of an interesting, maybe even controversial issue. But when you enter 100,000 lines, some of the sort of really fabulous moments in Mahabharata are either detours off the main narrative, and I'll try to give you one or two of those as we kind of tell the story in the next few lectures. They're either detours that have some relationship to the main narrative, or literally the text just stops and someone asks a question like, where did this come from? Or what happened in this place? Or you mentioned this character, so what's their story? And you'll go off for 4,000 or 5,000 lines into all kinds of stories that have literally nothing to do with the main narrative. It is literally just a greatness, a compendium of everything you ever wanted to know. Early on in book one of what's called the critical edition, the text audaciously says, if it is not here, meaning if it is not in Mahabharata, it is not anywhere. And the harder you press that line about sort of the great pressing human issues, the only other place I can think of where that is actually true is in Shakespeare. Maybe the Iliad. But that's we're hard pressed to find the depth and the magnitude and the sort of the strangeness of what it takes to hold this thing together. Now, how these suttas do it, being quite literally unable to read, is part of the puzzle of composition that led to the entire subject of oral poetry and oral composition, which really didn't begin until that period between the first two wars, because we needed a century before that, in some sense, to catch up to the idea that there were comparative mythologies at all. So I'll pause here and tell you a 30-second story, because, again, it's like 3 degrees of separation here back to the original, back to your question, which is who recited this? Who compiled this? Who are the kind of cultural figures at the center of it? And how did, and more interestingly, how did they do it if they didn't have literacy? Leaving aside that literacy kind of drives them down that sort of information pipe that allows it to happen at all, and that's Sanskrit. You know, like everybody's kind of converging into that river using the algorithms of the language to create a kind of continuity in the way in which the verses spin out. Well, the brief digression is that I used to sit outside a door. If you walk into the main library in Harvard Yard, it's called Widener Library, and you walk up the first set of stairs and towards the reading room. I don't know if you can go there anymore. I don't know what the access thing is anymore, but take a left, and there's a room called Room A, and on it says Sanskrit A. And next door is Room B, and Room B is the Milman Parry Room of Comparative and Oral Literature. Now, Milman Parry was this guy who, in his 30s, between the first two wars, started to study, was a student of Greek and then of Sanskrit, but he was a comparative linguist, and he got interested in the folk stories of Serbo-Croatian Balkan storytellers. And he went to the Balkans and found these folks who could recite thousands of lines of poetry by heart. And he began to see that what they were doing was something like how the Greek Iliad was composed, and then something like how the Indian epics were composed in the same way. Now, Parry had a student named Albert B. Lord, A.B. Lord, and he wrote a really magnificent, strange, wonderful book that you might want to read someday. It's called The Singer of Tales, and it kind of tells Parry's story, and it kind of focuses on how did they do this? And Professor Lord was still alive when I used to sit outside Sanskrit A with my little notebook, like, you know, in dire terror of walking into the room and sort of going through class, which was always just a scary nightmare scenario of testing your wits and your mettle. They could throw you right out. Like, you either sat at the desk or you sat at the side. You weren't allowed to sit at the desk until you could do the work. And then you weren't, and if you got it right, you weren't rewarded. That's the best way to put it. And if you got it wrong, you were asked to leave. So it was a pretty, and that's not a terrible thing, too, if you think about that, because the world doesn't need very many people like me. Is everybody clear about that? That is a weeding process. They're weeding you out to go to medical school, but we need way more doctors than we need guys who know this shit. Is everybody clear about that? So learning this was torturous, but Lord would walk by, and he had this just patrician, white-haired old man who looked like John Adams. Like, he had that white, like Grandpa Munster look with the glasses and the bow tie and the tweed coat. And he would walk by and he'd go, and he'd smirk and he'd chuckle and he'd go, Sanskrit students. You know, like those who torture, those who put themselves on the rack and torture themselves on purpose. But these two guys, Parry and Lord, figured out the sort of fundamental structures of oral literature. I'll give you the ABCs of it. Mahabharata is composed like rap is, but instead of using rhyme, it uses meter. It counts itself out. And then at important points, it uses what we call skeletons and cliches. So it's not an accident that Achilles is the swift-footed Achilles, time and again, or it's the wine-dark sea, or it's the wolf-bellied Bhima, or the left-handed archer, or the best of bulls, Arjuna, right? Or the lion-maned Krishna. These are all cliches that are stuffed in the lines so that at the difficult points of the rap, that's the easy part. Right, and then they leave open spaces. So they use cliches, and then they create skeletons around the format. The same way, you guys are all very hip to this because that is the music of your age, right? Like the way hip hop does its business is it creates structures and then fills in the blanks. And that's exactly what they were doing 2,800 years ago to compose Mahabharata. Right. So later on, so there's a late story that's in the movie, but it is not in your written text. And the reason for that is that that late story treats Mahabharata as if it were written composition. So let's tell a little bit of that story. And it doesn't appear in the critical edition because it doesn't appear according to the criteria of comparative manuscripts. So what happened in the 50s is these Indian cats got together and they gathered manuscripts from all over the country, and when they couldn't find the same story in all six corners, I think they used six places particularly, that didn't make it into the mainstream. That didn't make it into the text. It made it into what's called the apparatus. So if you go to the library and you take out the Sanskrit edition of the critical edition, there's the text on top, but then there's this line, and then there's all this stuff underneath it that looks like algebra. And it's really all comparative manuscript studies. Like, this is here, that's there, and then they're making all of these judgments about what's in the text and what's not in the text. This is not a story that makes it into the text, precisely because it is late. The idea that it is composed is a much later idea. And it invokes sort of the wonderful, strange, lovely god Ganesha, the elephant-headed son of Shiva, who is a kind of lord of thresholds, of beginnings, of crisis himself. You know, he's a teriomorph. He's got a human body and an elephant head. That's another story we study in other classes. I'm happy to tell it to you elsewhere. But he is in some sense like the Mahabharata, like he's higgly piggly, you know, he's put together from all different kinds of broken pieces and then kind of collected and then becomes the collector. And then Vyasa, who is both the reciter of the text, and in fact in the critical edition, he delegates the recitation of the text to his best student. Vyasa isn't in fact reciting the text to Ganesha. It's another guy who's really it's his student. He's sitting next to him, and he says, "Well, you do it." And so this early story sort of is kind of goes like this, and we see a little bit of it in the beginning here. Mahabharata is told as a flashback, as a reflection. So it's the great great grandson of the last living heir to the throne of the victors. Now, the victors are going to be our heroes, the Pandava, the putative sons of Pandu, which we're going to find out may in fact not be sons of Pandu at all, but nonetheless are the sons of Pandu. That's, again, another kind of broken, missing, extra piece understanding of how this thing is put together. The world is put together The world is put together of broken, missing, and extra pieces. And that's what makes it a love story. Because someday when you fall in love, you're not just going to build a life together. You're going to take all of your broken pieces, and you're going to find out that other people have broken pieces, and you're going to try to put those together in a way that creates something more whole, something more beautiful, something more possible. But when you sign up for love, you not only sign up for grief, you sign up for like all the shit you didn't know about somebody. This is what happens when you date, right? Like you go on a date, like 2 months out, you're having buyer's regret. Why? Because you're finding out who this person is, right? And what you're finding out is that after all the facades of romance and perfection and all the things you love are negotiated, you find out all the things you don't. Right? And you find out that they're just as hurt and wounded and screwed up by their parents as everybody else is, right? And you find out that they have their own issues. Now, you're all very so lovely young that the water under your bridge isn't quite so traumatic yet, but the water is already deep and cuts deeply precisely because Mahabharata says you came in that way. You came in a deep file. You are not a blank. You are not a blank slate. So putting together your own life, putting together a life of meaning and of intimacy is Mahabharata's important task. And part of what it shows you right here at the beginning of the story is that it's a story of memory and of forgetfulness. It's a story of compiling and putting together, but also of knots and of tricks. So the story goes that the last kind of, we're in the great grandson of the last heir. And he has set before himself a great Vedic ritual, a yajna, the very first thing we talked about in this class, you know, 12 weeks ago, organizing the world through the transactions of exchange between this world, between the seen and the unseen, between this world and all other worlds, you know, trading substances and recipes and organizational principles to kind of negotiate a world where you can make the sacred. You can go here, not there, this, not that, now, not then. You can kind of figure out where things go and what matters to you. That's what the sacred fundamentally asks. And so this king, his name is Parikshit, is performing this sacrifice. And it's a strange sacrifice. And then the story stops and goes on for several thousand verses to describe why he has such an enmity towards the snakes. So Parikshit's got this thing about nagas, N-A-G-A. The Sanskrit word naga is related to the English word snake. Right? It's the same cognate. The three words for snake are worth a stop here just in Sanskrit because it's so fantastically interesting. Naga, sarpa, S-A-R-P-A, is our word serpent. Right? But the third word really captures it all. The third word for snake that's commonly used is ahi, A-H-I. And that will take you to the German angst, or to the English anxiety. And so snakes don't have anxiety. They are anxiety. Which is why much later on, symbolically and ritually, the internal core of your awakening consciousness is understood as a wrapped snake in Indian consciousness. When you see the Ouroboros, when you see the snake's twisted in intimacy, that is the awakening both of desire and of consciousness, right? And why? Because fundamental to human nature is that to awaken is to be anxious. If you don't think you're anxious right now, hold your breath. Keep holding it. In about a minute, the anxiety is going to really catch up to you quickly. You get it? So all we're really doing is addressing anxiety all the time, for better and for worse. When you address it well, you feel happy about it, right? You feel excited about it, or you feel calm, right? You register, as the Gita explained, you register through the forces of nature, that they happen in your body. When anxiety registers to you as a liability, right, or as a peril, that's a feature just moments away from your ordinary experience, right? Because what you're really doing is you're addressing it all the time. You're making it go away all the time. Okay, so this king's got a certain kind of bee in his bonnet, a snake in his grass, and he's got an enmity towards them, and they're a whole class of beings, the snakes. And so he's there, and he's going to do this snake sacrifice to kind of negotiate himself into a better situation, which means he's really addressing the deeper issues of crisis and anxiety, and who are we is what he's asking. And so at the very event, which is kind of a staged symbolic representation, like why is everybody gathered to hear a story? Well, they haven't. They've gathered to do this ritual, this sacrifice, this snake sacrifice. Why this sacrifice? Because in some sense, it's the ahi, it's the angst that they're compelled to experience as who are we? How do we know who we are? What's our connection to the past? What kind of future do we want to create? That's what that sacrifice in a certain way represents as this kind of staging ground of the greater Mahabharata story. Okay, so now we're two generations away, long ago and far away. They're talking about their ancestors. And Parikshit is visited upon by this sage who now must be hundreds, if not thousands of years old. And his name is Vyasa. Now Vyasa's name is itself a kind of ironic and telling matter, because Vyasa means editor. It means compiler. It means the one who collects things. So what is, and we're going to see, of course, that Vyasa collects seed, that is, he collects ancestry. He's going to be the father. He's going to father the entire issue. He is, in fact, Parikshit's great-great-great-grandfather, something like that, depending upon how we think about that. And yet here he is. He's part of this sort of wonderfully magical world. You know, Mahabharata has a magic kind of like the way all great epic myths do. Like Game of Thrones has to have dragons and ghosty things. And Mahabharata does those things to remind you that we are not only negotiating mundane worlds and everyday existence. We're negotiating a deeper, sublime sensibility of how we operate indirectly through symbol, through metaphor, through the magical as a kind of detour from the ordinary to kind of ask ourselves what more and what else we could be. So, and in that sense, epic is an interesting category that Vyasa is dealing with, because epic is a subcategory of myth and legend that's really the story of us, right? It's a nationalist story. This is one of the reasons why the Peter Brook film was so controversial, right? It's that it wasn't just Indian people, and Indian people took it personally that foreigners were telling their story. Well, that's all very well and good, except that's the play inside the text. That is, if it is purely epic, then in some sense it means to be our history, the history of our people. Who are we? Is the epic question. And yet, because it's rife with what we might call the ordinary magic of Indian thinking, you know, sages thousands of years old, the presence of gods coming in and out of the world, visible and invisible worlds converging, different kinds of organizations of time that kind of question whether linear time is the only kind of time. In other words, it lifts us out of the ordinary and the everyday banality, which epic in a certain way as pure history would want us to think, well, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about our ancestors here. But in fact, we're talking about something that's richer, deeper, stranger than that, because we're talking about the history of consciousness, the history of memory, the history of human identity, the history of what it means to live in invisible worlds. What kind of invisible worlds? We all live in invisible worlds, right? Why? Because in the most ordinary way. Every all of the crisis that the country is currently facing politically is a feature of the history of the country. The hearings tomorrow in Congress are filled with scholars talking about what the Constitution means. They're talking about our ghosts, right? They're talking about our past. They're talking about the strange, mysterious way in which we are the result of invisible worlds long bygone. Okay, so Vyasa shows up, and the prince here, who is the king, whose ancestors are going to be the answer to the question, who are we and where did we come from, the epic question, says to Vyasa, well, who are we? And Vyasa says, well, if I recite this story, you'll learn it, but much will be forgotten. And Parikshit wants it to be remembered for all time. And so he says, well, can we write it down? And Vyasa says, well, it goes really rather quickly, and no ordinary human could do that. And he says, but among those who could do that is Ganesha, that is the lord of the Gana, the lord of the rabble, such as it is, the lord of thresholds, the elephant-headed god, the beginning of thresholds. He's going to appear in the movie version, as I said, but not here in your text. And Ganesha appears, as it were, because he's buds with Vyasa. Because, you know, if you're a sage, you have an elephant-headed god friend. You know, it's just kind of like, why not? You know, that's entirely plausible. So Ganesha shows up, and he says, the problem here is that as competent as Vyasa is, I will be bored by this. I love this part. It's kind of my favorite part of it. Like, yeah, I could write this down, but this is just too mundane a task. And so Vyasa gets it in his head, because he's rather sagely, that the answer is to that is, well, okay, let me put this stipulation on it. I will recite the text, but you have to remember every word of the text, but not only remember it and write it down, you have to understand everything that's said. And Ganesha kind of wobbles his elephant head and says, that's not a problem, I'm Ganesha. I mean, he's pachydermian, that he has an elephant's memory and majesty and strength and sort of internal wit. I don't know how much time you've ever spent with elephants, but they are the smartest, dearest things you could imagine. And they really do have prodigious memory, like ancestral memory. So, but then Vyasa then gets the idea that, well, to fulfill this, to get this written down, he's going to have to do something to in some sense, trick Ganesha to get this to work. And so what he does is he says he's going to put in granthas, G-R-A-N-T-H-A. Granta means not in Sanskrit. That is, so what he does is he puts in grammatical incongruities. He makes deliberate mistakes, which in Sanskrit are a big deal, right? Because you're playing by the rules algorithm and you're not supposed to make mistakes. And these mistakes, which are part of the recitation of the Mahabharata, the ordinary part of the recitation of the Mahabharata, Ganesha has to kind of pause and figure out, because he's expecting the language to be right. Because he's Ganesha. He knows all the rules and he wouldn't make mistakes in Sanskrit. But there are, and now what in fact this part of this myth is doing is it's not only telling us how the text moved from oral to written forms, it's also telling us it's justifying something that epic Sanskrit shouldn't have, which is it has mistakes. Right? It has knots in it, grammatical incongruities. Like you're kind of reciting along and the verb doesn't match, or the compound is not quite right. It doesn't do its business properly. And in the critical edition, when you go downstairs and kind of pull out the text, when they edited the text, when there's incongruity, they put a little squiggly line underneath the text, which means when they compared all the manuscripts, they still couldn't find one that didn't have a mistake in it. Right? So they're justifying the mistakes. These are called aetiological myths, that is, myths to give reasons for things. And so part of the reason for the mistakes is that it's rap. Like, this is a natural kind of strangely organic Sanskrit that's being used by these Sutta artists, right? That they tell this story that the mistakes are put in there on purpose by the sage Vyasa to slow down Ganesha. Is a kind of sweetness. And then we're also told one more piece of the Ganesha story, because it's really vitally interesting, that to fulfill this promise, Ganesha takes his tusk, one of his two tusks, and he literally breaks it. He mutilates himself, think about this, to etch, because they're not, because he to use his tusk as a stylus. Because old Sanskrit is etched into bark. It's not inked, right? So he's not using his tusk as a quill. He's using it as a stylus to kind of etch into a harder surface, as if he were carving out the text. But think about that. The god mutilates himself for the sake of humanity. That is, he breaks himself to do what? To tell the story of who we are. So you can't tell. So what does the divine do? It decides to tell, it decides, it agrees to tell the story of who we are. We, of course, have to tell that story with mistakes, with knots, with grantas built into it, so that that story can in fact be recorded. Because unless there is difference, unless there's incongruity, unless it breaks, you'll miss it. Now, think about that for a second. Like one of the amazing U of R experiences are the low flying landings, right? Like you're sitting next to Rush Rees, and like there's like a plane looks like it's gonna like tip off the top of the library because the airport's like right over there, you know, it's like right over there, and the good news is plane lands safely is not news. Everybody got that? You're kind of hoping not to be in the news when you go to the airport. Is everybody clear about that? Don't make the news is the answer, right? But when you don't make the news, there is nothing to notice. Right? And Ganesha and Vyasa wants this to make the news. So it has to break. It has to give you a reason to care. It has to give you a reason to pause, to wait. You're going to do this. Like, you go on a date, you fall in love. Don't pick out the dishes right away. You got to break some first, right? Like, you got to find out. You got to find out people's broken and missing and extra pieces. Because you don't know, you don't. Because if it's all smooth sailing, you're not ready for a storm. No smooth sailing ever made a better sailor, right? So he conjures the storm, and then the divine breaks itself, right? In order to tell that story, keep this entire model in mind. That it's in the seams and in the spaces of the in-between. And again, that's why it starts with the snakes. Because who are the snakes? The snakes are the creatures who live in stillness and in movement. But when they move, they go everywhere. They're anything. They're the space in between. They're the opening. And without that, the world can't exist if it doesn't break. That's how it evolves. That's what mutation does. But the world also, and this is vitally important, isn't beautiful. Right? You can stare at the blank wall, but we live in a wood tent, essentially on the top of a frozen hill. It's a timber frame. Made of Georgia pine, right? But it's all the knots and the breaks and the cracks in the wood that make it an interesting place to live, right? If the walls were perfect such as it is, it would be boring. And so part of what Ganesha is telling you is he's telling you that unless the world breaks, it doesn't achieve its real beauty, its real value. Beautiful things are broken things, right? Because otherwise it's uninterrupted. It's just whiteness or silence. As Mozart said, the music lies in the space between the notes. That is, there has to be difference. There has to be space. So even this sort of late conjured story is kind of pointing to this sort of deeper archetypal sensibility that things that love and intimacy and beauty and creativity and growth are all features of worlds that, in some sense, have to be broken, and then someone has to break oneself in order to break into oneself. And that might be Ganesha's greatest message here, that to tell your own story, you're going to have to break into your own self. And that might, by the way, might involve some mutilation, that is, some kind of tearing yourself apart to find out who you are. Because he breaks his own tusk to write his own story. Okay. What follows next follows from the way the story unfolds. So let's try to find the major part of the narrative and then understand a little bit more, both because Parry and Lord, those two scholars, gave us an understanding of how this colossus was evolved, like how they managed to pull this together. But I'm going to try to give you another kind of set of insights to understand it structurally, to look at it. So what happened was, you'll remember this from earlier in the semester, when scholars discovered Sanskrit. They thought that they had found the motherlode. That is, they thought they had found the oldest language that took back all the Indo-European languages. They thought they had found the source of Greek and Latin. What they had found, actually, was another ancient language, which, when compared to all the other ancient languages of the same family, pointed back to the mother, and that mother we call Proto-Indo-European. So they missed that story, but the linguistic similarity was the heart of the matter. So what happened was, the second piece of this, is that if there's linguistic similarity, they made a second error, but this too was corrected. And that second error we've already mentioned as well. And that's that because the language pointed to content issues, say the god Zeus of the Greeks is the god Diaus of the Vedas, right? That these two words are linguistically related. Does that make the mythology related? Does that mean that this god is that god? Well, that's what they first thought, and they were mistaken about that. That is, they drew too close a cultural identity. Because what gods do, in fact, is they re-reflect back to us our own worlds and concerns. And so while linguistically these two point back to a common culture and to a singular linguistic origin, by the time they arrive over here in Greece and over here in India, they are re-representing the values and the issues of those peculiar cultures. However, There's two ways into this that are still fascinating. So what happened was a French scholar. Named Dumézil came along, and we combined with another French scholar named Émile Durkheim. Now Durkheim's name is a name you should utter with reverence, bowing slightly in his direction to touch his lotus feet, because Durkheim's one of the five great thinkers of the 20th century. Durkheim is essentially the originator of almost all of the fundamental cliche ideas of modern sociology. Durkheim's fundamental thesis is this, that individuals make up society, but society creates the individual. Full stop. Pause. Well, that should sound as ordinary to you as the ending of a Beethoven symphony, right? When you go, oh, Beethoven, cliche ending. And the answer is, he invented that, right? So it was Durkheim who showed us that societies are more real than individuals. They're more real because they're more durable. They're more foundational. It's a cold winter day. But you didn't come here dressed just because it's cold out. You came here dressed and in a certain way, because those are the compulsions of the world around you. You're made by something greater than yourself. Human beings are organized socially, right? We might be the smartest. I think the whales and the owls have that on us. But we are certainly the most cooperative, because we didn't get here alone. So Durkheim's thesis is that certainly there's individuality, but individuals are made by forces and energies greater than themselves. And those inheritances of society are in fact so real that until we understand those as creating us, we can't understand how we imagine that we create ourselves. So every way in which we do create ourselves is in some sense a conversation, a response to this much larger, embracing, coercive, compelling force called the social. Okay? Now, it's more complicated than that, but we can study that further in another class. So what Durkheim gave us was this idea that when we look at Mahabharata, we are looking at a paradigm first of Indian culture, of Indian society itself, that every character in the story, in some sense, represents an element of the social fact, that they stand for more than themselves because they're representing what society is back to themselves, with the fundamental claim that goes back further, which helps us to understand Dumézil and the early linguists, that people invent the gods that represent themselves. Let me put it another way, as perfect blasphemy. God, we make God in our image, not the other way around. And that's kind of fundamental to the sociological study of religion. That is, we invent the gods that tell us who we are. And that's going to, and we reshape and reclaim those gods to look like us. Right? That's why that that funny picture in my Italian grandmother's kitchen of Jesus, you know, like he's like praying and then crown of thorns, like, you know, like when you turn the picture this way and that. Well, I mean, why he bore such a stunning resemblance to my brother David? Well, because if you're an Italian lady, your Jesus looks like your Italian kid. Has everybody got that? Like, that's kind of how this is going to go down. I'm being glib here, but I'm making the point. Now, Dumézil was this French scholar, and what he did is he took up again the idea that when we study cultures comparatively, we can find in them the Durkheimian principle. That is, if in fact the Greeks and the Romans and the Serbo-Croatians and the Celts and the Slavs and the Saxons and the Norse are all somehow connected as well to the Indians, that inside that larger structure of society, we might be able to see how the characters in these stories represent these principles. And so what Dumézil came up with, what was called the tripartite theory, okay? And the tripartite theory said that there were three functions, he called them, of society. They were the sacred, they were the warrior, and they were the commercial. Commerce, right? And that this basic tripartite structure could be used to interpret Roman, Greek, Slavonic, Serbian, any Indo-European mythology. And then here, our principles, who are going to be the Pandava, are going to re-represent these functions, and that we have to understand them, as Durkheim understood it, structurally, right? So in a structural understanding, what that means is we have to understand everything because of where it fits in the structure with respect to everything else. So we've already begun to see a little bit of this in our studies. We can't understand what priestly Brahmin ritualists are doing without understanding what warriors are doing. We can't understand the warriors without understanding the Brahmins, without understanding the servile class, without understanding the commercial classes. In other words, the very structure of what we've already talked about, Varna, Ashrama, Dharma, that is the structural world, the law, according to estates and stages in life, that those models are re-represented in a structural way so that we only understand what Brahmins do when we understand what Shudras, what the most servile people do, and that to see Indian worlds is to see their sort of strange and complementary relationships. I pause there for just a second to sort of get the point. If we had to conduct a funeral today, a Hindu funeral, we would need three things, right? We would need an ancestor, usually a son, but someone to light the pyre. We need someone connected to the dead, okay? Then we need a priest, right? Why? Because we want to get that dead in the cycle. We want to get that person back to the sacred. We want to go, okay, like here to there, this to that, now to then. We need transitions. We need rites of passage. We need to sort of organize our lives to make sure things work out. And then what's the third person we need? So we need an ancestor, a living ancestor. We need a priest. Who else do we need? Think about it. In a social structure. Be practical. Turn it into 21st century terms. If somebody dies, who do you call? What do you make preparations for? You're so insulated. You don't even think about this, do you? You need a funeral director, right? What do you think the funeral director does? They deal with the dead. They touch the body, right? They're going to bathe you. They're going to dress you, right? They're going to put you in the box before they burn you, right? So you not only need the priest, you need the Shudra. You need this person who's on the other end of society, right? So in India, you need the person with the greatest social status, the priest, and the person who's the most, in some sense, over there, reviled. And you need an ancestor. Those are the three things you need. And you can't conduct a funeral without those three things. That's a structural argument. Get it? The priest doesn't do that. The priest doesn't handle the dead. Doesn't lay you on the pyre. Doesn't dress you in the fabric, right? Okay, so Dumézil came along and he gave us this tripartite model. And he told us that the model is not only structural, but the structure itself works on a kind of interesting inherent wobbliness, that is to say that there's space in it, that it's filled with inherent conflict. And so when we go, Mahabharata, we start with the five brothers called the Pandavas, right? The eldest of the brothers is Yudhishthira, right? Now, you haven't done the work and you haven't watched the movie, so you're not following me exactly right here, but please go do the work and this will start to make better sense to you. Yudhishthira is going to be king of kings. The first structural understanding of the Pandavas is that they must be taken as a unit, right? They aren't five, they're five individuals that make one thing. The thing that they're representing is the entire body of the Indian world and all of its issues. Yudhishthira, as the prince of princes, as the controversial heir to the throne, and Mahabharata is essentially a story of conflicted succession, because these are our heroes, the Pandavas. The villains of the story are called the Kauravas. We'll put them in this structure later. But let's just try to understand the basic premise here. The elemental claim here is that Yudhishthira aspires to the sacred. He aspires to set things to rights. Right, to hold things of value, and to make that distinction plausible, because sacred and profane, here, not there, this, not that. You can do it now, but not then. So it's a way of organizing the world and setting it apart in meaningful ways, right? So that when you finish Thanksgiving dinner, you do the dishes, right? That is, you have to make order and remake order. You have to know what's appropriate and what isn't. That's what holds the world together. That's Dharma. That's the topic we work through in the Gita, right? And he's going to be the Dharma king. And one of the things that makes the Indian world really exceptionally interesting isn't that the king is Dharma, it's that Dharma is the king. Pause on that, because the current Republican Congress should learn this lesson. The president isn't the law. Right? The law is the law, right? So the king isn't the law is king. Get it? That's the principle of Dharma. But that's in conflict. Why? Because as one aspires to the sacred, one is going to have to use other kinds of forces, because no matter what happens in that idealized king, he's going to have to deal with difference, with conflict, with different interests, right? As we go through Mahabharata, they're going to make alliances. They're going to figure out who's on the team, who's not, who's the villains, who aren't. And what do you have to do? What does the law always have to do to function in conflicting interests? It has to make compromises. It has to cut deals. And Yudhishthira, and in the best of all possible worlds, you wouldn't cut a deal, right? You'd go, I'm on principle. This is the truth. This is the best way. But that's not how the world really works. So Yudhishthira is in inherent conflict between the sacred and the real politique, right? You want your candidate to stand for uncompromised, incontrovertible truths, but in fact, you've got to live with real differences and conflicting interests. Underneath the sacred, however, is the warrior. And the warrior function is going to be twice divided here. We can get through this rather quickly in just a few minutes, because that's all we have left, right? The warrior function is going to be twice divided. Why? Because Yudhishthira is himself divided. The warrior function is divided between Bhima and Arjuna. Bhima is the big hairy man. Bhima is the organic warrior. He's the wolf belly. Did anybody see The Lord of the Rings? Bhima is Gimli. Tolkien makes him a dwarf, but in almost all other stories, he's a giant. He's big, he's hairy, he's organic, he's got passions. We'll talk about his passions. We'll talk about their alter egos next time. When they go into exile, we find out who they really are. Bhima's complement is Arjuna, who we've already met at the Bhagavad Gita, right? Arjuna is Legolas. Arjuna is Achilles. Arjuna is the beautiful warrior. Arjuna isn't this giant man who's wolf-bellied like Bhima and carries a club. Arjuna is so stealthy, he shoots the eyes out of a crow, left-handed, upside down. Bhima is the natural warrior. Arjuna is the cultural warrior. And so the warrior function is force. But there's the forces of nature, and Bhima is a force of nature, and we'll talk about that as we go forward. But Arjuna is the force of culture, which is what further now finally explains his meltdown at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. What's his meltdown about? It isn't about the killing. That's a natural thing, and everything dies. It's about how does this hold society together? Why is this culturally okay? How do we do this? The last two Pandavas are twins. They're going to represent, as it were, the commercial, the economic function, the economic interests. And notice that they're subordinated to the other two. Dumézil, this French guy, wrote voluminous arguments in comparative mythology and comparative culture to try to show that all Indo-European societies work on this that all of the mythologies work through the model of the tripartite function. Now, the argument against it is it looks too broad to actually, wouldn't this apply? Why would this apply to Indo-European phenomena if we're comparing, say, Greeks and Romans and Indians and not elsewhere in comparative mythology? And the answer is we have to figure that out. But this is the core of it. Durkheim gave us society and language. Dumézil gave us comparative mythology. Start here. Start looking for this broader sensibility of the archetype and see that each of them is in conflict, but never in conflict with themselves. The Pandavas are perfectly fidelitous to each other. They act like one living organism. Okay, we'll pick it up again on Thursday. There are no office hours today. We'll have extended office hours next week when you're really working on your stuff. Thank you.